You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with four guests who are each organizing for renters' justice, stopping gentrification, forming cooperatives, building affordable housing, and decommodifying buildings while asserting that housing is a human right. Join us as we speak with Andrea Chiriboga Flor, Mike Dennis, Antonio Gutierrez, and Kali Yakuno with the Homes for All campaign and the National Renters Day of Action that took place in 55 cities throughout the United States.
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Aguanu, hello and welcome. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawn Land in Wooligisket. It's a beautiful day here in Bunawabskig territory, located in and along the shores of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine. And I'm joined today, as I am always, by my illuminating co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. It's wonderful to hear your voice in our recording this afternoon. We are going to have an action-packed show today on Love and Revolution Radio, but there's a couple things I want to mention right before we start. One is thank you to our donors. We put a shout-out out in our weekly email that we send out with about the show, and I'm very grateful for those who did contribute. That helps us keep doing the show, and we love it when you help us out. So thank you. Also, I want to thank the people who went to their local radio stations and asked them to carry Love and Revolution Radio as part of their weekly programming. It is available for any radio station to do that, so all you basically need to do is ask your station manager to stick this into one of their open slots. So thank you to everyone who took action this week to do something like that. We really appreciate it. So we're going to talk about the recent National Renters Day of Action that just happened on September 22nd this year. It was a big event with many cities involved, and we actually have four guests on the line today to talk about this event and also the ongoing year-round work that they're doing in creative and strategic ways to make change on this very important issue. I don't know about you listeners, but I myself am a renter. I know Sherry's a renter, and this is an issue that's near and dear to our hearts. We get it. Just to give you a brief overview of who's on the line with us, we have Kali Yakuno, who is with Cooperative Jackson in Mississippi, Andrea Chiriboga Flor, who's in Colorado, in Denver, with 9 to 5 Colorado. We have Mike Dennis in East LA with the East LA Community Corporation, and Antonio Gutierrez, who is in Chicago, Illinois, with the Autonomous Tenants Union. I think you can guess, listeners, from the just even the groups that they're working with, that this is going to be a really intriguing show. Welcome, everyone, and I'm going to hand it over to Sherry to ask the first question and get us off and rolling.
Thank you, Rivera. I want to start out by going to Mike Dennis and ask you, Mike, can you just give our listeners a framework for the National Renters Day of Action? Let us know, what is it all about and what are some of the things that you're looking at and trying to address through this action?
Thanks for having me on and for raising awareness around this really important issue that I think that we know actually affects the majority of Americans. We currently have over 100 million renters in the United States. The number is actually a little bit higher than that. And the community-based organizations that have been working on tenants' rights for a couple decades now have banded together under the Homes for All campaign banner. And the Homes for All campaign was born out of another alliance called the Rights of the City Alliance, which has been fighting gentrification and displacement since its formation. And the Homes for All campaign had a national convening in Chicago in April of this year. where we convened dozens of organizations that are working on different strategies to address tenants' rights issues, to increase the creation of affordable housing, to preserve public housing, looking at a lot of different housing strategies for keeping our communities whole. And we made a collective decision that we needed to really push housing justice front and center in the national conversation. We hear a lot going on around wage increases. We hear a lot about the environment, but really housing is one of these things, particularly when you're looking at national politics, is just not discussed. And gentrification is something that's happening everywhere right now in the United States, but isn't being discussed by our elected officials. So the National Day of Action's goal was to raise the stakes and put it front and center for folks. So 55 cities across the United States planned their own local actions. Some of the strategies that folks are working on are creating or protecting rent stabilization in their cities, which is a way to keep tenants from being frivolously evicted by their landlords. We're looking at ways of creating, preserving more public housing. We're looking, of course, at the production of affordable housing. So there's a lot of strategies that folks did, and each city had their own version of the throwdown. Some cities did very high intensity escalative actions. Some did more low intensity. So it really depended on sort of the comfort levels of those organizations. And I would also mention that all these organizations are community based. So they all have memberships. They're all doing grassroots community organizing and long-term leadership development work with their membership. This isn't electoral organizing where it's about big numbers and low quality. This is really about building strong fabric within our communities to protect these communities from neoliberal policies and gentrifying forces.
Wow, thanks, Mike. This is music to our ears here on Love and Revolution Radio, where we do talk about long-term organizing and nonviolent struggle quite a bit with our listeners and a variety of different issues and causes. So we are very heartened to hear all this news. I want to come back to you in a few minutes and talk about some of the work that's going on in East LA that you guys are working on. But I'd like to go over to Andrea for a moment and ask her a little bit about the renter state of emergency in Denver, Colorado, and the importance of and why development without displacement is so important. Andrea.
I work with 9to5 Colorado, as you mentioned. We are a mostly women's labor organization. So we work on labor policies that lift up women in the workplace. Some of our allies have been asking us why we're working on housing. It doesn't seem, in our 43 years of existence, we haven't done this. And it just, we've gotten to the point where we just have to. Our members are leaving, they're getting displaced, they're not in our communities where we're working. And we started working on this because of the fast tracks build out. So RTD, our public transit system, is going through a very big build out to the tune of a $7.6 billion project. And along all these light rails, which covers the metro area, people are being displaced rapidly. And right now, actually, Denver, in terms of rising cost of rent, we are second after Seattle right now in terms of how quickly rent is increasing, and it's projected to continue increasing in the next couple of years. And we're also seeing one of the things that we're focusing on is mobile home parks. There are a lot of mobile home parks in Colorado, especially in Adams County. It has one of the highest densities of mobile home parks in the U.S. And so we know that mobile homes are affordable. It's one of the only affordable types of housing. And what we're seeing is now that there's this desire to build high-rise buildings and hotels and all these shopping malls and things like that, these parks are closing pretty quick. And 99% of the time, mobile homes actually are never moved during their lifetime. And so they're not actually mobile. So what happens is these houses are just thrown away once the property is bought, and it's just a private exchange and there's no federal money going into this exchange. The landlords are actually not required at all to give people any kind of compensation. So your $35,000 to $80,000 investment could just be scrapped. And so a lot of the folks who join us for the Day of Action are living in mobile home parks who are at the threat of displacement. And another phenomenon we're seeing is people are not aware that they have to pay property taxes, which I think is kind of bizarre that they do because they don't actually own the property underneath their mobile homes. And so people are knocking on their door saying, hey, you haven't paid your taxes. I just bought your house. It's mine now. And so there's a lot of issues going on with that. And that's just one of the focuses that our organization has. And so on this Renters Day of Action, we identified several of people's top issues through a survey we did, and cost was absolutely number one. And so on the Day of Action, we actually released a report with all this data, just basically looking up the biggest barriers people have to finding housing and staying in their homes. And so we had a press conference in the morning in front of the Denver County Courthouse, which on average about 130 people are evicted every week just from Denver. So that doesn't include all the other surrounding cities that are in very similar situations. And so after that press conference later on that evening around 6, we gathered at that same spot, and we actually had Aztec Dancers lead our march from there. And we also had someone from the Black Lives Matter movement of Denver 5280 kind of kick us off, because we want to be really intentional about recognizing all the different struggles that are happening right now and the different movements and how interconnected these issues are. So we all marched to the Capitol, which is about a block away. And we had about 10 of our community members all from different places, Denver, Arvada, Aurora, Commerce City, Thornton. It's just growing and growing. And we want to make sure we had different folks from different cities to show that this is not just a Denver issue. And they told some very, very powerful stories. Most have either been evicted, displaced, or forced into homelessness, or a combination of those things. And then following that, we had a vigil to commemorate all those folks that have been through that. So the theme for the day was rolling out our demands for rent control. And Colorado and Oregon, we're both doing that day. This is the first time we're telling our legislators, this is what we want to work on. Come work with us. We're calling on you to do something about it immediately. And for the first time, we were also declaring a housing state of emergency. So overall, there are about 150 people. And, you know, we made it clear that this is just the beginning, and this is going to be led by the people who are impacted the most.
Andrea, you know, when we look at these types of issues, you know, Rivera and I have worked on a number of issues, and we each have our areas of focus, and we do a lot within nonviolent strategic planning. One of the things that's really clear is that when we look at a number of these issues, identities, privilege, oppression, all of these things are really intimately connected and can't really be segmented from one another. So when we're thinking about this issue on a broader scale, if we step back, do you have a vision of what real, successful, intersectional movement around these issues would look like?
So I think I'm slowly creating my vision, but it's very clear on when we're looking at just even like on our small scopes of who we're working with. So for example, in mobile home parks, it's mostly Latino folks that are living there. A lot of folks who are undocumented, a lot of folks who live in fear and don't know that they have rights as homeowners, or don't know who to call when their property taxes aren't being paid or things like that. And so this is also an immigration issue. Definitely. Another thing we've seen is, you know, a lot of women who are living in domestic violence relationships, they can't leave because they don't have financial stability enough to actually move out and have their own place because prices are too high and wages are too low. And so, you know, things like minimum wage is also a part of this. And we see that as a huge factor. And that's another campaign we're working and we're actually mobilizing around. And we got it with other organizations on the ballot this year to raise it to $12. And another thing, I think one thing that really pulls in a lot of different demographics is background checks. So in Colorado, we're an open record state, meaning you can go back as far as you want. Like someone I know so that as soon as she moved in, the landlord said they were going to go back 30 years into their record, and she's 32. And it could be for anything. It could be for a conviction that, or it could be something you weren't even actually convicted for. People can write you off of that. And the folks who are being impacted by this is mostly people of color because of police brutality, because of a police state and systemic racism. And kind of similar background checks also, we've seen, or credit checks are disproportionately affecting people of color as well. And so I definitely see my vision is bringing in all these movements that folks experiencing homelessness right now. Like, they want tiny houses. They don't want more services. They don't want more shelters that are overflowed and have these restrictions where they feel like they're in prison. They want tiny homes, which is very similar in some ways to mobile home parks. And so, yeah, I definitely see how all of these movements intersect, and we're seeing more and more those groups coming together. Another one of our allies who came to the table is Padres y Jóvenes Unidos. So they work with parents and youth in schools to improve schools in various ways. And they approached us and said, we have to work on housing. Our people are saying, why are we improving these schools if they're going to be for somebody else? So yeah, I see with time pulling this together and being very intentional about making sure people's movements are lifted up in the right way and that there's intentional connections, because sometimes I think what's hard about creating these coalitions and intersectional movements is feeling like everything is just being thrown on the table. We just have all of these demands that they're just, we're just making a list. But that's not true. We know these issues are connected. And I think with time and slowly building relationships with these other movements, we can do it in a way that lifts up all of our issues.
Well, thank you for that. I'm so glad that you said all of that. It's so important. And I want to turn over to Kali in Jackson, Mississippi, and hear from you for a little bit. I think you can bring another angle and dimension into the conversation as well. And also you can just share a little bit about what Cooperative Jackson is trying to achieve as in its long-term project, and how housing is a human right, and then the relationship of the Black and women's liberations movement to the long-term strategy that you're working on.
Well, first and foremost, our project is really concentrating on decommodifying as much land in our community as we possibly can. And we're going about that fundamentally in two different ways. One is purchasing as much land as we possibly can to take it off of the market. And we take it off of the market by putting it in the community land trust that we're developing. And the second piece is just kind of going around organizing in the community with homeowners and with folks who are without homes, finding out which pieces are kind of currently vacant, and working to put those areas back into some productive use, either directly into housing, but more widespread at this stage in the game in our development, into agricultural production, which is primarily managed by one of our cooperatives, which is called Freedom Farms Co-op. And the purpose and aim of taking as much of the land and taking it off the market as possible is to end speculation, first and foremost, which is beginning to be rampant in our community. Second is to make it deeply, deeply affordable. And number three is to put it under direct community control. So there's a democratic use, you know, for this most vital and precious and first and foremost of resources. So that's a critical piece to our overall program. And the broader vision of what we're trying to do is kind of summarized is called the Sustainable Communities Initiative. And with that, we're trying to build a working class based live work community that is anchored by the CLT that provides cooperative housing as well as cooperative employment and almost anything that you can think of that services a human need that we're developing. So that ranges from childcare to education to farming to we're trying to get into some light dimensions of what we call community production, which is small scale kind of manufacturing of our direct needs and provision of services. So we're in the beginning stages of the broader aspect of the community production in the provision of housing. But we've made some significant gains over the past 2 years and actually acquiring and picking up land in the community, both by acquiring it from the state, but more importantly, by just working with the community to identify what's vacant and putting that to use. So this is a critical piece to our strategy, plan, and vision. And really what we're, you know, what the Sustainable Communities Initiative is about is not just in, you know, providing jobs, not just creating ecologically sound and stable community. Those are some core components of it. But we're really trying to build a new economy, you know, a democratic economy that serves people first and foremost over profit, and to put all of the commons, to restore the commons, but to put all the commons back to kind of community democratic use. Now, that's a long haul, but we know it's possible from the little experiments we've been able to do, kind of to scale to date over the past 2 years. And we're just really working diligently to build it up and get it to scale as soon as possible, because we are facing a major declared threat of gentrification, you know, which is coming and has been announced. It's very public and open, and we're very much in a rival kind of position with some major developers in our overall kind of political project, which has been going on now for about 10 years. So that's trying to do it some justice in a snapshot. But I guess for your audience, let me just give a breakdown a little bit about Jackson so folks understand the context that we're working in. Relative to your question of both about the Black liberation movement and intersectionality. So Jackson is roughly 200,000 people. 85% of our community is Black. Roughly a little bit more than 10% is white and fairly affluent. So you have a major contrast between kind of white affluence and Black impoverishment, which is pretty deep in Jackson. It's one of the overall kind of poorest cities in the country. We're not at the level of vacant land and property as, say, a Flint or Detroit, but we're not that far behind. Land here is still relatively cheap in terms of the open market, but the some of the major plans that are coming down to make Jackson a home of kind of the expanding medical industrial complex with a real focus in on diseases created by living in impoverished conditions, such as diabetes and heart failure and hypertension. There's a lot of experimentation that these hospitals are planning on doing. And they're doing a lot of speculation on some of the core communities where the Black community is concentrated in our city. So we are very explicitly in contest with that and doing everything we can to stop it, but not just stop it, to rebuild the future, really, in the interests of our own community and in accordance with our community's desires and needs.
Kali, I love what you said about decommodifying the land. One of the things that I often speak about, which is of great concern to me, is the commodification of nearly all of the elements of our existence. Mm-hmm. The commodification of the land, the commodification of the water, now with these new carbon deals, the commodification of our air. Every aspect of our lives is commodified and broken down into some type of capitalist value. And the importance of decommodifying these elements of our existence are really critical because they actually change the value structure away from a profit margin back toward the quality of life and the valuation of life by placing the people first and the ecosystems contained within the common that you're creating first by developing these agricultural programs and other things that can help support and sustain the community. And that's really at the heart of this idea of, I don't want to say ownership because it's not the right word, but
it's
much broader than that. Like indigenous models, our community, for instance, Onowabskek community, the Penobscot Nation, we hold our land in common. The land is all owned ultimately by the tribes. Individuals can have portions of that land to live on and to build on and can trade those interests to one another within the tribe, but those lands can never be sold outside of the tribal community. And one of the things that was done historically was to actually break that up a little bit to try to weaken our interests. And so the strength that is gained by actually holding land in common can't be overstated, that there is a real benefit to everyone involved when the land is held in common. And so, you know, this is taking us back to a more common sense way of living in relationship with one another. I have two questions that I want to pose to you. I'm sure that you've seen some real difference in the way that your community interacts as a result of this work, that there have probably been new relationships built and other relationships deepened as a result of coming together as a community to do this. So I'd love to hear about some of those things. That's the first piece. The second piece is, given where you are and given what's been happening across the country, do you have any concerns about eminent domain taking of those lands in light of some of the things that have been happening all through Florida, Alabama, and Georgia? There have been hundreds of landowners that have come out and filed suit because their lands are being taken by eminent domain by the oil and gas industry for private profit rather than for the community good. And so have you thought about anything related to that and what steps you might take to protect those lands and prevent that from happening?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you kind of got into the heart of what we're anticipating. And I think the level of new relationships and strength that we're trying to build, understanding that, you know, we live in a Tea Party state. And what do I mean by that? Just for the audience, our governor is a member of the Tea Party, and our state legislature, which is possesses a supermajority at present, is fundamentally dominated by the Tea Party. So some of the more reactionary elements and proponents of neoliberalism kind of run the state apparatus in the state of Mississippi. So we anticipate being attacked. There's already various levels of being attacked, our project being attacked primarily around some of our climate justice work, first and foremost, is kind of how it's registered. Also some of the work that we've been trying to do in terms of creating new relationships that are about liberating working people and changing our relationship both to capital, but also our relationship to the land and to each other. So there's been some directed things coming down the pipeline on us. Our city is also under threat to possibly lose control over its water system, which now provides over 40% of the city's kind of annual revenue. So there's a major direct attack against Jackson and that we're constantly mindful of, which I think helps us to build deeper relationships. But we feel like we have a long way to go still, I think, to get to where we ultimately want to go and I think need to go to be able to have the strength to kind of beat back, you know, their control over the state apparatus to be able to kind of change laws or manipulate laws. You know, we're going to have to build some genuine people strength on a deeper level than Jackson and also to work with some of the broader communities in the state so people kind of recognize our joint interests. And that being, you know, with the Choctaw and that being with primarily white working class communities to the eastern part of the state. These are some critical things that we're going to have to scale up and do and deepen some relationships. We have some already, but you know, they have to go much further in terms of kind of meeting the force that we know is coming. Now, one interesting thing that kind of works in our favor, just to end with this, several years ago, when our organization became clear that our organization and the organization that this our project is born out of is the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and that we were going to be in whole state office and particularly control the mayoralship of Jackson, Mississippi, which we did for several short months when Chokwe Lumumba was alive in 2013 and 2014, they changed the law because of one of our campaign planks that we were going to use eminent domain to actually put more of the community's kind of vacant land in a commons held kind of relationship. So the state legislature, this Tea Party supermajority, then went in 2013 and changed the law to remove the power of eminent domain actually from the state. So in that sense, they've, in a short-term way, eliminated the threat of them coming back to use it. But we all know, and we don't have any illusions that as they want to do more fracking in the state, as we become more of a threat, that they'll either change the law or they'll just do what they've done so often, which is abrogate what they put on paper and just exercise, you know, direct kind of military type force to exercise their will. So we have to get prepared for both, quite frankly. And that's what we're trying to do diligently as we possibly can.
And we'll be back speaking with our exciting guests after a quick break for a station ID. Let's return to our program. Andrea, let's come back to you for a moment. We only have you for a short time this afternoon before you have to take off early from the radio show. Would you share with our listeners any thoughts that are brewing in you that you feel are important before we have to say goodbye this afternoon?
We are thinking about more what Kali was saying. Community control is super important for us here in Denver, and I think or in Colorado in general, and one of our strategies is Community Land Trust or cooperative, and bringing Rock USA, resident-owned communities USA here would be huge, that they actually just invest money in buy mobile home parks specifically, and then have the folks living there pay them back, which is pretty cool. But like organizations like that who have that capacity so that communities can actually control their land and own their land is so critical. And I feel like the policy level is important, doing things like just cause eviction, limiting application costs, limiting background checks, credit checks, things like that is absolutely critical. And continuing to build the capacity to do that long-term systemic strategy work and on the ground dealing with, you know, working with folks who are on the verge of being evicted and bringing those folks in as leaders and engaging them in a way where they're taking ownership and are empowered enough to make change in their own communities is the goal and the strategy for a lot of this, to build that vision of intersectional movements coming together and having folks be financially dependent, own their own home or their communities. So I would just say that, like, I think that's what we're going to continue working toward. And I also just want to say Homes for All really is an amazing campaign and coalition and has brought all these people together. And after that retreat we went to in Chicago, where we met a lot of the other cities that are doing this work, we just knew we have to do this. We have to be a part of this. This is exactly what our communities are asking for. And so really without Right to the City and all the other cities that have become a part of this, we would not be where we're at.
And thank you for everything that you're doing, Andrea, including joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having us.
I want to invite Antonio Gutierrez to chime in because we haven't heard from him yet, and we definitely do want to. Antonio, would you share with our listeners a little bit about the work that you're doing with the Autonomous Tenants Union in Chicago and why it's autonomous? I think that's a question our listeners will be having. What's significant about that?
Of course, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be on the show. So my name is Antonio Gutierrez, and I'm a tenant organizer with the Autonomous Tenants Union. The Autonomous Tenants Union is an all-volunteer organization committed to organizing for housing justice from below and to the left. We also believe that housing is a human right, not a commodity, and we fight for an end to all evictions and for community-controlled housing through the building of popular power. So we are autonomous because we are creating this concept of working with those directly impacted below and to the left, and letting them decide how we are building this movement. How are we resisting the many day-to-day struggles that we have that we're facing because of our many identities? Here in Chicago, when talking about what we did for the Renters Day of Action, the Autonomous Tenants Union was able to get 10 different housing organizations to form this coalition that planned the Renters Day of Action for about 2 months. prior to September 22nd. We had a rally that focused mostly on renter testimonies around eviction and displacement here in Chicago. And we were outside in one of our public plazas downtown in front of the eviction court, in front of the building where eviction court proceedings happen. This is Daly Center. And then after that, we did a human chain symbolic action around the building itself, where all the people that participated and attended the rally were able to create this beautiful human chain saying, stop all evictions, all unjust evictions in the city, and asking for just cost eviction, something that we don't have here in the city of Chicago.
One of the things that I think it's important for people to hear that you just said is that there's no just cause eviction in the city of Chicago. So people can just be evicted at will for no reason whatsoever. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. So most of our buildings that we're organizing tenants unions in, they fall under this kind of speculative market where new owners are coming in and buying these multi-unit buildings in areas that are being gentrified, mostly communities of Black, Latinx, Native, and Asian communities here in Chicago. They're buying these multi-unit buildings and giving 30 days notices to all the tenants at the same time to do mass eviction, to later on do mass rehabbing and increase the rent of all of those units, which are naturally affordable, into double, triple, or sometimes four times the former rent that the current tenants were paying. So we're coming in and kind of creating these tenants' unions and working collectively to make sure that people are not displaced and that they get a chance to, with popular power, be able to negotiate with these new owners and be able to stay in these buildings.
Antonio, one of the things that everyone is saying and people are catching on as citizens, as renters, is that gentrification is such a major issue striking our communities all across the country. I'm wondering, what is one of the most effective tools and strategies that you are seeing in countering gentrification, in stopping up, as you described, the mass evictions and the mass the changes of ownerships of buildings? What are some of the effective strategies that people should know about for working on this issue?
So one of the tools that we use here in Chicago and in our work, and that I know that other cities are also using and implementing, is the formation of tenants unions, right? And then when we also talk about decommodifying our land and making sure that it's community control, we're using the tool of the community land trust to create real affordable housing, right? We understand that with the current capitalist system, that the system itself is not going to be able to provide adequate housing to all the people, and that it sees housing as a commodity instead of a human right. And so we see that with this tool of community land trust, we can really start having much more of a democratic decision-making in the hands of the communities about what happens to this land and what we can create together to provide the resources that we need to thrive as a community, from housing, from food, cultural spaces, education, jobs, et cetera. So we really see this tenant union formation and the community land trust model as the tools that we're using in order to decommodify housing and to change the narrative about housing as a commodity to a human right.
I couldn't have asked you to summarize it up better in my own estimation of some of the most effective tools. Thank you so much for bringing up those two strategies. I want to invite Mike to speak again, this time about the work that you're doing in East LA with the East LA Community Corporation. I've heard some rumors, and I don't know as much as I'd like to know, about how you guys challenged the landlord lobby. And I also hear that you are a founding member of Homes for All, this campaign that has been a great coordinating effort between all of the different groups that we've been talking with today on the show. So thank you. I'm looking forward to hearing a little bit of your own story, Mike.
I appreciate that. It's a lot of pressure, but I would start by saying that ELAC, my organization, you know, we're based in the neighborhood of Boyle Heights, which is a couple miles east of downtown Los Angeles, is extremely at risk of gentrification, is facing a lot of gentrification pressures right now. But when you're looking at Los Angeles as a whole, there are dozens of communities that are in the same or worse condition than Boyle Heights and Boyle Heights renters. And so my organization, we actually build affordable housing, and we do community organizing, movement building work. So we have kind of a unique tightrope that we walk, because we have the analysis that Antonio Kaliev shared, that housing is absolutely a human right, and that we seek to ultimately decommodify land and put it in the hands of community control. But we also recognize that there is a just transition that needs to happen. We can't shift the capitalist economy overnight, but there are strategies that can help us do that. I think some of those have already been outlined. For us, one of the most important strategies for providing immediate relief is by no means comprehensive. It by no means reaches all of the folks that need it, but it is creating affordable housing and buying up as much land for affordable housing as possible. The way we take it off the market is by putting 60-year or more covenants on these properties. So regardless of whether we disappear tomorrow or not, those properties have a covenant that cannot be removed, and that keeps them affordable in perpetuity. And so that is an important tool in a system that ultimately isn't meeting those needs. And so that's why we're involved in movements like Homes for All. We're heavily involved in Rights of the City. And we support our allied organizations across Los Angeles that are doing direct tenant organizing, that are pushing, you know, more radical approaches to the housing crisis, because we believe that, you know, there's a lot of strategies that need to be employed at the same time if we're trying to beat back the growing forces of gentrification. So, you know, we were part of the original conversation when Homes for All was sort of conceived. I think it was very much a collective effort. I couldn't point the finger at one group that was directly responsible for it. I think it was a beautiful sort of collective process that came out of a lot of conversation with directly impacted tenants. And for Los Angeles, on the Renters Day of Action, we formed a coalition, ELAC and a bunch of other groups in LA, you know, just to name a few, the LA Human Right to Housing Collective, the LA Community Action Network, Strategic Actions for a Just Economy, the LA Tenants Union, which is newly formed. So a lot of these groups came together several years ago in Los Angeles in response to the absurd housing crisis that Los Angeles has been facing, where we're seeing rents going up, you know, $1,000 overnight for some folks that make $20,000 a year and they're feeding a family of four. And so we called on city council in LA to recognize that there was a renter's crisis by declaring a renter's day. It seemed like a very simple sort of low-hanging fruit that we could go after in organizing spaces. And then it sort of blossomed into us actually winning some policies. LA, for a little context for listeners, has rent stabilization. It's had rent stabilization since 1978. And we have just cause eviction laws. Now, the main focus for the opposition has been to dismantle rent stabilization, reducing the amount of tenant protections that folks have. So there's a very strong real estate and landlord lobby in the city of Los Angeles and the development community, which we are not a part of, even though we develop, is very, very powerful. And so Renters DLA pushed city council to strengthen a lot of the rent stabilization protections, because in the city of LA, there are 680,000 rent stabilized units. Those are one of the strongest portfolios of affordable housing that the city will ever have. No amount of construction of new affordable housing will meet that scale. And so it's really important that we don't lose that. We've been losing those housing units every year to LS Act evictions, which is a California state law that allows developers to pull rental units out of the housing market in order to do condo conversions and things like that. So Renters Day LA came out of that initial demand. And on the Renters Day of Action, we've traditionally always targeted City Hall elected officials. They're always the easiest ones to beat up, to be totally frank. They can't say what they really think a lot of times. And it's easier for us to have leverage when you're talking about an organizing strategy. And we never hold the private sector accountable. So we felt like it was really important that we went after the organization that's probably the most directly responsible for the landlord abuses in Los Angeles. And that would be the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles. They're a 100-year-old organization. They're explicitly
dating back to their founding, anti-socialist, anti-communist. Red stabilization is a communist agenda. So they've got deep roots in LA from the alt-right. And so we marched with about 350 folks from mid-city Wilshire area in Los Angeles to their offices. We were allowed inside of their lobby. And once we were inside the lobby, about 100 folks packed inside the lobby and demanded that they sit down and meet with tenants at a meeting that we're convening later in November. It was a great display of community power. We had community organizations from all over the city participating in the action. There was a very strong police presence, which, again, that just kind of speaks to the nervousness that law enforcement and public officials have towards organizing movements that are nonviolent movements. But, you know, it was a great way for us to really call out one of the largest culprits, one of the most critical elements of the pushback on tenants' rights, because these are the people that ultimately control political campaigns. They control lobbying in City Hall, and they don't ever poke their head out, and so they never get any heat for it. So we felt like we needed to flip the script a little bit and go after them.
Mike, you guys are doing some fantastic work out there in LA. I've been doing some research on what you've been up to. And one of the things that I think it's important for people to consider as we look at these issues that are really across the board is the vilification of the poor and the glorification of this kind of mean-spiritedness that leads to decisions that often undermine those who are the most at risk in our society. And so, you know, the name of our show is Love and Revolution Radio, and you're certainly all doing a lot of revolutionary work out there to change some of these things. My final question to all of you, if you could all weigh in on this individual, and we'll start with you, Mike, is what do we do to address the other issue, the issue that's at the heart of all of these things, which is the separation of people from their own hearts and seemingly at times their own conscience in regard to their treatment of other human beings? How do we humanize those who seem to have consistently across the board certain populations less and help to bridge that gap, that mental and emotional gap that leads to a lot of these kinds of really sick decisions within our society that keep people who are downtrodden down? How do we start seeing them as human beings again and helping to lift them back up to a place where they can live their lives with some dignity?
That's a really great question. I think that's something that we, certainly myself as an organizer, we grapple with this every day. I mean, you see a lot of internalized oppression across the board, whether it's in small groups in member meetings even, or if it's when dealing with your local Tea Partier, right? So I think for us, we really try to prioritize compassionate communication and creating open spaces where there are opposing dialogues, where folks can have honest conversation as judgment-free as possible and try to find paths to some understanding. And I think it's been successful when we have dedicated the time to doing that. And I think the trap that we all fall into is that there's never that time to do it. And because we're constantly being attacked, we ultimately embody that oppressive behavior if we don't check ourselves. And so I think for us, at least with our membership base, it's really important that we're sifting through disagreements and understanding different perspectives where people are coming from. Not saying that, okay, you're right, but I get where you're coming from. Now let's move forward and do something. When we're doing campaign work, you know, we're working on other issues related to economic justice. It's so important to humanize the debate and put the directly impacted front and center. I think that's a big mistake that a lot of community organizations, particularly the nonprofits, make, where they don't center the lives of the most directly impacted folks, and they end up doing advocacy. And that's where the door is left open for opposition forces to exploit and use fear as a tactic to keep the status quo the way it is.
That is such an intriguing reflection about the humanizing of the movement. And, you know, I also like to talk about humanizing the opposition, which has the same effect, but in the opposite direction. That just as they're trying to dehumanize us, when we dehumanize them, we miss some strategic opportunities that might otherwise unfold. Such a key understanding. This is a great question Sherry's asking, because I am often caught up in the revolution and sometimes forget the love. So it's I'm reflecting on it as we're going along and doing some closing remarks on this theme. Antonio, would you like to chime in about this? What role does love play in the revolutionary work that you really are doing out there in Chicago?
Yeah, of course. So when we see internal oppressions, as Mike was telling us, we think that the best way to kind of deal with that is with love and empowerment. So it is with empowerment that we can really start getting into more of a collective agreements and actions and thoughts that really can take away from this individualism that we've been kind of have come to understand and have normalized as far as how we're supposed to act within society. But here within community organizing and empowerment and love spaces, right, we get to really create a sense of belonging and a sense of community that is away from that dialogue that we've been kind of institutionalized to believe in. This institutionalized belief that we are only individuals that only should cater about our own needs and not the needs of others. And so when people come to our spaces, whether it's because they're an impacted resident that is facing eviction, or they're just wanting to learn about their rights, or they're wanting to understand a little bit more about their own situation as an undocumented renter in our community, they usually tend to see more of the side of what can we do together and how can we all learn from each other, because we all have these amazing experiences that we all have come with, and how can we start having collective dialogue about what we need to do in order to change these individualism views that we have and perceptions into more collective thoughts and actions in order to get us to a movement that would change the overall national dialogue about housing and about many of our other different struggles, from being, you know, woman, queer, undocumented, an immigrant, Black, and to stand in solidarity with each other, and for really what that really means to stay in solidarity and action every day.
Thank you, Antonio. I think that, you know, those are all very important aspects of the ongoing work that we have to do as a species. Humanity has this work to do, not just those within these collective movements. It's a global consciousness shift that we're needing. Kali, I'd love to hear your final thoughts on this matter before we end the show today. What do you have to say about love in the revolution?
Well, it sounds like, you know, between what Antonio and Mike described, we are using a lot of the same methodologies and I think really being patient in our organizing, and in the midst of the struggle, I think that is something that we're learning to do to try to find a calmness and a stillness, and also a reverence and spirituality that we're trying to also incorporate in our work, that I know both of them kind of alluded to in different ways, but it's something that I'm just bringing up so it's not missed. And it's also a very explicit piece of some of our work. My co-director is actually an Ifa priestess, and that is something that she brings to the work in a way which is not imposing, not trying to make anyone a convert or believe anything, but just bringing a constant, you know, grounding in, you know, what connects us to each other, what connects us to, you know, the life force, the life-giving presence of the earth. I think is something that she brings as a valuable skill to our overall work, our overall consciousness. And I think it's something for us that we are constantly working with and struggling through ourselves and with our membership, is to also kind of re-engage our place and our relationship to the earth. That is something that we are doing as part of our just transition work, to reground people on the land, reground people in place, and get people really kind of prepared to come with solutions and develop solutions, you know, to this imminent climate threat that our entire planet is facing as a result of human activity. And how do we create the solutions in our everyday practice and our everyday engagement and decolonize, you know, our relationship to each other, to the land, and decommodify much of the current system and how it constrains us, constricts us as we possibly can in the hearing now. Because we definitely agree that we're not going to change the entire system overnight, but we want to be and are trying to be very intentional step by step in figuring out how does each action that we take, how does it change social relationships? How does it change our overall relationship to the earth? And, you know, it's a great process of experimentation where we're often making as many mistakes as we are going in the right direction. And I think going back to just being patient and living in that patience is a deep act of love that we're trying to walk through and live through in our work as a way of kind of leading us forward. So I'm just hearing a lot of synergy in our work, which makes me feel very proud. It makes me feel that we're heading in the right direction as a movement to not only kind of deal with the housing crisis, but I think the deeper issues of colonialism and capitalism and imperialism that we're all facing.
Thank you for all this beautiful conversation that we've been able to have today, Kali, Andrea, Mike, Antonio. I'm just very deeply honored to be doing this work with you and not only have you on Love and Revolution, but also have you embodying the love in the revolution. Thank you.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to all of our guests, and especially to Malcolm with Homes for All and Right to the City for connecting us with all of these great people. Thank you to Kali Akuno with Cooperative Jackson, which you can learn more about at cooperativejackson.org. Andrea Chiriboga Flor, who is in Denver, Colorado with 9to5 Colorado. You can find out more about that at 925.org. That's the number 9, the word TO2, and the number 5.org. Thank you to Mike Dennis with the East LA Community Corporation. You can find out more about the work he's doing at www.elacc.org. And Antonio Gutierrez offered us some really insightful strategies for working on this issue. He's based in Chicago, Illinois, with the Autonomous Tenants Union, which you can follow on Facebook at Facebook/Autonomous Tenants Union. We are really grateful for all these guests, and I'm also super grateful for my co-host, Sherry Mitchell. Thanks for another great show.
You're welcome, Rivera. Thank you, as always. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, Words and Music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And if you liked what Sherry said and maybe even want to catch a little bit more of her thoughts on this issue, you might check out her Sacred Instructions Facebook page, where you'll see more of her thoughts and reflections on issues going on today and matters of the heart. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and as we said at the top of the show, thank you to everyone who has gone to their local radio station and asked the station manager to add it to the program. It's changing hearts and minds across the country. Thanks for being a part of this. You can reach us with any questions, comments, or concerns via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com. And if you like podcasts, we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. This week we heard from four amazing organizers who are working with various organizations around the country to secure homes for all. The issue of income disparity is one we've talked about often, but it is only the tip of the iceberg. Housing inequity and housing obstruction has become one of the most significant forms of oppression in this country. The lack of concern for the well-being of those being displaced is an ugly reflection for us all, and one that we cannot afford to look away from. So, listeners, perhaps you'll take some time and look around at the rental trends in your community and see if there might be ways that you can help to ensure a home for all by the time we talk to you next week.